We here in Iowa continue to be pummeled with TV ads and visits from the biggest names in American politics. But don't despair. It'll all be over in 1 week. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Political scientists Dennis Goldford of Drake University and Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa join me to offer their analysis of the latest polls. We'll focus on the races for Iowa's three open congressional seats and look at some other contests around the country that may tell us what to expect next Tuesday. Also, Ebola, where science meets politics. And this hour, our social media question, give us the state of our politics in 5 words or less. Our conversation starts after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, a Politics Wednesday edition of our program. Joining us with their analysis, Dennis Goldford in our Des Moines studio, professor of political science at Drake University. Hello, Dennis.
Hi, Ben.
In Cedar Falls at our studio there, Chris Larimer, associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa, University of Northern Iowa. Excuse me, Chris.
No problem.
Good afternoon to you.
Hello, Ben.
Well, we're 6 days away from the election, gentlemen, so we have some looking at polls to do. I would like to also talk about all these ads we've been seeing, see what you see in those ads. Looking at the Des Moines Register article on this, all told, since late June, Iowans have been subjected to more than 57,000 U.S. Senate ads totaling nearly $30 million. We'll talk about what's been in those ads in a few moments. We also want to reach out to our listeners this hour. Our questions on social media, give us your take on the state of our politics in 5 words or less, or what will you remember most about this campaign season? You can go to, you can email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. Find us on Facebook and put your 5 words on the state of our politics or what you remember most about this campaign season. Chris and Dennis, you don't get off without being asked that question toward the end of the hour, so I hope you'll be thinking about it. Let's talk about the latest polling. Let me turn to you, Dennis. Let's look at the much-watched open Senate race. What are you seeing in the polls?
Well, it's still evidently too close to call. We saw the Loras poll come out yesterday with a slight lead, a percentage point roughly, for Bruce Braley. And the Quinnipiac poll came out also yesterday or first thing this morning with a couple of point lead for Joni Ernst. Interestingly, neither so far has hit the 50% mark. So the question, of course, in these final days is what will make that difference? Are there undecideds at this point who will actually make the difference? So you, at this point going in, you're probably a little bit more comfortable if you're Joni Ernst than if you're Bruce Braley, but you're, neither one really is comfortable at this point.
Mm-hmm. We see that many of the polls taken on this race in the last few days have been within the margin of error, usually putting Joni Ernst slightly ahead. So does that give you the same feeling, Chris Larimer, that you'd rather be Joni Ernst than Bruce Braley at this point?
Yeah, I think that's a tentative yes. You know, as Dennis said, they're certainly within the margin of error. But this late in the game, if you're seeing a consistent, you know, 2 to 3 point lead, even though it's within the margin of error, that would probably give the Ernst campaign a little bit more comfort than the Braley folks.
Mm-hmm. I see in both of these polls, 5% in the Quinnipiac poll remain undecided. In the Loras College poll, 8% they're saying undecided. So this comes out, this can all be a matter of turnout, a key in this race. Chris, do you think one party has an advantage in terms of motivation to turn out?
Well,
or
I think
the machinery to turn them out.
Well, yeah, I think those are actually two different things. I think in terms of motivation, it's probably an edge to the Republican Party right now because of all the disgust that we see in the electorate with President Obama, the Obama administration generally, and some of the policies or lack of policies by the Obama administration. But in terms of machinery, we certainly know that from 2008 and 2012 that the Obama campaign had an unprecedented team of analysts put together that you know, really pushed them over the edge. You know, even though, you know, the polls showed a pretty tight race in 2012, the Obama camp knew based on the analytics they had been running up until Election Day that they had a pretty good edge going into Election Day.
And embarrassed many pollsters, did they not?
Right, yeah, exactly. And I think the question this time around is, you know, have Republicans actually caught up on the analytics of getting people out to vote, on mobilizing voters who maybe haven't previously participated in a midterm election? I don't think we'll know that until after Election Day. If they've done that, then, you know, the Ernst campaign can be pretty comfortable. But if this is a case where Ernst has a 2 to 3 point lead with every poll going up to Election Day, and then Braley wins by, say, 2 points, then I think you're going to see some serious rethinking within the Republican Party. I think you're going to see a very serious effort, if it's not already underway, to hire analysts to really take a hard look at how they get people out to vote and their mobilization techniques.
Dennis, when you look at a poll, what do you look closely at to know how to weight that poll in your mind?
Well, I look at the poll's experience or history. How close have they been? You know, there's one pollster out there, I won't mention the name, that seems to be consistently leaning in a Republican direction. That doesn't always come through with some surprising results, as we saw in 2012, for example. But the question I guess I'm looking at is, as Chris already mentioned, number one, what sense of turnout does the poll suggest? You know, when you've got to go from registered voters, and you can pretty well get a sense of what their views are. The trick is, in terms of modeling your poll, how do you get from the category of registered voters to that smaller category of likely voters, and then again, your even smaller category of actual voters? And that's what determines how accurate your poll can be, how well you model likely voters. I mean, the Romney people in 2012 really were off the mark in terms of who they would see as turning out. At the same time, you know, even with an Obama win, say, in Iowa in 2012, in fact, looking at Iowa numbers, Republican turnout exceeded Democratic turnout in Iowa, 82% to 77%, and independents trailed with about 63%. So the question is particularly in these tight races, when they ultimately break, undecided voters aren't necessarily independents, but they're likely more likely to be independents than others at this point. Will these people actually show up, and which way will they break?
Mm-hmm. In terms of eligible voters, what percentage of eligible voters are likely to turn out here? We're in the, 40% range, Chris?
Well, I think in terms of active registered voters, you're probably looking at turnout in Iowa of roughly 50 to 52% of active registered voters in the state turning out to vote. I would expect a total turnout of, you know, maybe 1.2 million voters in Iowa, which if you consider the amount of money that's being spent that you mentioned in the introduction on television, that's pretty significant amount per vote. But I think, you know, you're probably looking at 50 to 55%.
But could I note, and again, not to try to hit radio people with a lot of numbers. Mm-hmm. Yeah, in 2010, using the numbers I compiled from the Secretary of State's website, which is excellent to use for that, mm-hmm. turnout in Iowa in 2010 was about 53%. But Democratic turnout was about 56%, Republicans 69%, and independents only about 36% mm-hmm. in 2010. So again, the odd thing is that this race, whether it's the tight race in the 3rd District or the 1st District or certainly the Senate District, may well end up being decided by the people who are least likely to turn out and least interested in the election, which would be independents.
And I think Dennis is right, and I think I would add to that, the key group or an interesting group to watch are the people who were non-voters in 2010. Are the parties targeting those folks? Are they trying to get those non-voters from 2010 out to vote in 2014? Because that could sway the Senate race as well.
Well, with those few number of undecided voters out there, we're certainly all being pummeled by the TV ads and various sorts of online media ads. As I mentioned, nearly 60,000 ads on TV about the Senate race, totaling some $30 million, nearly $30 million. That's just since June. Let's talk about the content of some of the ads that we've been hearing. I want to play first of all something that we've had here. One of the ads. Let's just get your first impression before we do that. How would you, Dennis, compare and contrast these two campaigns looking at their TV ads?
I did an op-ed piece 2 weeks ago in the Register on that, arguing we were being disserved by both campaigns in this regard, particularly if you look at the ads. There are three types of ads, I think, in each campaign. One is the ads run by the campaign and candidate himself or herself. Those may be somewhat negative, but often they're positive. Then there are the ads by the party committees, the National Republican Senate Committee, the Democrats. Those are, in fact, to me, have been the nastiest ads, the negative ads. And there are the ads by the independent groups, the Steyer environmentalist ads, the Koch brothers or Karl Rove, Americans for Prosperity and Crossroads ads, things like that. But if you look at the ad, and those all seem to be almost overwhelmingly negative. But if you look at the ads run by the campaigns, so many of the Bruce Braley ads, at least as I watch them here in central Iowa, were themselves negative against Joni Ernst. Only in the last week or so have we been given the semblance of something positive from Bruce Braley about Bruce Braley. On the other side, the Ernst ads have, as I put it in that op-ed, the Ernst ads basically have been her taking a strong position in favor of butterflies, honey, and sunshine. In other words, there's no real content. So in the most recent ad, she says she's strongly in favor of preserving Social Security for our seniors. Well, nobody's arguing against that. The question is, what about Social Security for succeeding generations? So she's selling a personality that comes across as sincere and wonderful and down-home Iowa, but there's not a lot of content in her ads.
Okay, let's listen to the ad I think you're referring to, her most recent ad. She gained, of course, national attention early on in the primary, her spring ad called Squeal. That was when she, of course, mentioned, "I grew up castrating hogs on an Iowa farm." And it's called the Squeal. Let's make them squeal, the payoff for that ad. Here's her latest ad from Joni Ernst, where she is back in the pig pen.
It's a mess. Dirty, noisy, and it stinks. Not this lot. I'm talking about the one in Washington. Too many typical politicians, hogging, wasting, and full of, well, let's just say, bad ideas. It's time to stop spending money we don't have and balance the budget. I'm Joni Ernst. I approve this message because cleaning up the mess in Washington is going to take a whole lot of Iowa common sense.
One of the more recent ads by State Senator Joni Ernst. Let's put that in contrast to a Bruce Braley ad, a recent one, where Joni Ernst makes this aesthetic appeal to Iowans. Bruce Braley goes with specific concepts. Here's his latest ad where he goes after what he calls Ernst's support of tax breaks for companies that send jobs overseas.
This election isn't about Joni Ernst or me. It's about who will be best for Iowa. Iowa has lost tens of thousands of manufacturing jobs. Yet Joni Ernst wants to keep giving tax breaks to companies that ship jobs overseas. I say it has to stop. We need to eliminate tax breaks for companies that outsource our jobs and cut taxes for companies that hire American workers. Huge corporations don't need a senator. You do. I'm Bruce Braley, and I approve this message.
Chris Larima, which approach do you see being more effective?
Well, I think they're just two very different styles. I mean, you know, what Braley's saying in that second message has a lot of policy in it, which can potentially get lost on voters. But it's an attempt to say, you know, the alternative, yes, everything in Washington may be broken, which is what the Ernst campaign is trying to do. And in that ad, she's indicting the whole lot of members of Congress. She's indicting Republicans and Democrats that everything in Washington is terrible. It's, something that we see every election cycle. What Braley's trying to say is that the alternative is even worse. If you go with Joni Ernst, the policies that would come out of that are even worse. So I think in both cases, there's a chance for those to be effective. It's an easier one to remember with Ernst, but it's something where it's a very simple message, as Dennis mentioned. There is absolutely no substance there other than saying Washington is broken and everybody agrees that, Washington doesn't seem to be working as well as it could.
Okay, let me put it this way. Which candidate's ad team would you hire?
I'd hire the Ernst ad team. I don't know that serves the public well, but the ads have been brilliant. The scripts have been brilliant. The effectiveness have been brilliant. They don't tell us anything in detail or substance, but I think the Ernst ads have been just a brilliant campaign.
And we have sort of slogans coming out that are very memorable. Joni Ernst, the Iowa way. Going back to what you said, Dennis, that That can mean anything or nothing.
That's right. I think to a great extent, and I think we talked about this as far back as June, she's basically framed this race as the good, virtuous Iowa country girl with those country values versus the evil big city slicker lawyer of Bruce Braley.
Mm-hmm. What is your view, Chris, on whether most voters choose a candidate based on who they instinctively like when they see them in an ad, for instance, or do they dig down into policies?
Oh, it's all about who they like. It's who they can connect with, who they feel comfortable with. I mean, people vote for people that they like, and I think it's that simple. And so a message that can convey that connection or make you feel comfortable with them is probably going to be effective.
Let's talk a little bit about last week. Joni Ernst canceled or declined to meet with editorial boards at several major newspapers, including the Cedar Rapids Gazette, the Dubuque Telegraph, Herald, and the Des Moines Register. First and foremost, that's the largest circulation daily in the state. Dennis, was that a gamble? What kind of thinking went into that decision? Obviously, some did.
My best guess is that, number one, they were willing to take the damage of, to the extent there was any, of canceling the interviews, as opposed to the possible damage of her agreeing to the interviews and making a huge mistake. What that means, in other words, number two, is that I think they must believe they have a very thin lead and they don't trust her enough to preserve that lead and keep it safe interviewing with newspapers. I think the thing about, well, we know where the Register stands, they're against us, I think that's just hogwash.
The Register endorsed Mitt Romney over Obama in 2012, right?
And they endorsed her in the primary.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Chris, your view on that?
Yeah, I'm not sure that I think Dennis is probably right. They probably looked at the polls or had something internally that suggested that, you know, they could go on with this without going to sit in with the Register and other papers. But I think, you know, in terms of the effect next Tuesday, you know, it's going to be pretty small unless you're an undecided voter who is looking to the newspapers for help as far as how you're going to make a decision with two candidates are extremely different in every aspect if you actually look at their policy stances. You know, it's probably going to have a pretty small effect on the outcome.
Do newspapers, their editorial boards and the endorsements they have carry the weight they used to, Dennis?
Well, that question answers itself. No, they don't, because there's so many other news sources and information sources and opinion sources now. That's part of the problem for newspapers. I mean, I'm not knocking newspapers. I'm a dinosaur. I love the feeling of opening a fresh newspaper. But unfortunately, from the newspaper industry, there aren't many people like that left. So, no, maybe in small towns, if there's only that local news source. But no, they just don't carry the weight they used to.
When we go back to the ads and looking at this campaign season, in still keeping with this Senate race here, what claims have you heard in this campaign? We say there is very little substance, but when there is substance on policy, what have you heard, Chris, in this race?
Well, you know, it's somewhat difficult to think about the substance of the policy, at least from the Ernst side. You know, it's that Bruce Braley votes for Obama 100% of the time, at least, or at least the majority of a significant amount of the time, and that a vote for Bruce Braley is a vote for all of Obama's policies. I mean, that seems to be the message. Mm-hmm. In terms of policy. On the other side, you know, they've gone back and forth on Social Security, but in terms of actual hardcore policy stances where they try to differentiate themselves, I think, you know, Dennis's editorial a couple weeks ago hit the nail on the head. There hasn't been a lot of policy differences. It's not as though they're coming out and saying, I'm for this, I'm for that. It's just, you know, anti-Obama or anti-Washington rhetoric versus this other candidate is too extreme for Iowa.
Factcheck.org took a look at some of the claims in this race. One of the claims made that Joni Ernst would privatize Social Security. The facts on that, according to Factcheck.org, she hasn't proposed or endorsed a plan to change Social Security. In fact, she opposes any changes in Social Security for current seniors or workers near retirement age. For Braley, I guess the claim being made there that he skipped an important VA reform hearing to attend three fundraisers. That fact false, according to factcheck.org. None of the fundraisers were scheduled at the time at the as a congressional hearing that Bruce Braley missed. So, Dennis, are there other claims here that you think weigh in here?
Well, as Chris said, it's been so hard to tease something substantive out of what they've been saying. I mean, the Braley people have hit Joni Ernst over the personhood amendment with regard to abortion and the effect upon abortion rights and indeed contraceptive rights. The fact that she again has privatization of Social Security as something she'd be willing to consider, not that she's proposed it, nobody says she has, for people who are not presently on Social Security. On the other hand, Braley probably has voted high in the 90 percentile range with the Obama administration, but do we know what percentage of the time State Senator Ernst has voted with the Republicans? We're not given that information, although somebody could find it out. And we've never had any kind of clear answer from Congressman Braley about if he's missed these meetings, why has he missed these meetings? He's never put that to bed.
Let's talk about, before we have to go to break in 3 or 4 minutes, control of the overall Senate. Iowa, one of the key races, a half dozen races that are looked at as pivotal here. Control of the U.S. Senate, Republicans, Democrats locked in tight races in key contests across the country. What other Senate races, Chris, are you most interested in when we talk about control of the Senate?
Well, I think you mentioned there are a number of them out there, whether it's Alaska, Louisiana, Arkansas, North Carolina, Kansas, Colorado, another one. You know, in several of these states, Obama's approval ratings are quite low, as they are in Iowa, whether they're the low 40s, high 30s. But, you know, I'm looking at Kansas, I think, is an interesting one, where you have incumbent Republican Senator Pat Roberts actually being challenged by an independent candidate. Pat Roberts is being heavily criticized just for not being in Kansas enough. And so there's a potential for a Republican incumbent to go down. So with all this talk about Democratic incumbents being in trouble, you actually have a Republican incumbent who might be in trouble by an independent candidate in Kansas. So I think that's an interesting one to watch. You know, I think what's going on in Colorado, where you have a representative challenging Representative Cory Gardner challenging the incumbent there, Mark Udall. Again, a state, Colorado, that has gone for Obama, where you might have an incumbent senator. Incumbent Democratic senator lose. The other Democratic senator from the state is chair of the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, so that would be a case where you'd actually have the chair of the committee losing one of his own state senator. So I think, you know, Colorado, Kansas are two of them that I'm looking at. You know, I think North Carolina is another interesting one.
We've got a minute or so before break. Let's go to Dennis for your view. What are you looking at in Senate races outside the state?
I think the ones Chris mentioned plus Georgia certainly is an interesting one as well. But I think broadly speaking, it's very possible that the Republicans, and I'd be more surprised if the Democrats held the Senate, but I think Republicans are likely to capture the Senate this time. But in 2016, the Democrats will have 10 seats to defend, the Republicans 23. We could have the Senate flip back to the Republicans, to the Democrats in the 2016 election.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so but we're not done with this election yet. So,
right.
And it's not yet. Some people may say, well, all of this prognosticating beforehand to create some voter apathy. If it's already forecast, I guess we know from 2012, though, there can be surprises. Right.
That's what makes all this worthwhile.
Okay. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about the Senate, but mostly we'll talk about some of the other open congressional races here in Iowa. We have open congressional races in the 1st District and also in the 3rd District. We'll get our analysts' views on those races. Dennis Goldford is with us, professor of political science at Drake University. Chris Larimer, associate professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. Our social media question this hour: give us your take on the state of our politics in 5 words or less, or what will you remember most about this campaign season? We have a number of them. 5 words from Dave: silly, stupid, sad, soul-sucking. Sorry about that, Dave. Best politicians money can buy, the tweet from an anonymous Iowan. Tell us what you think. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. We're on Facebook. Or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Back with more of our final politics day before the 2014 midterm elections. Back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. 1 week from today, it will all be over. The campaign season, which may have seemed long and something that's hard to endure considering how many TV ads we've been pummeled with over the last few weeks and months. It will all be over next week at this time. We'll be looking at the winners, the losers, dissecting the campaigns, and perhaps, though not necessarily, know who will have control of the Senate. The U.S. Senate in the hands of the Democrats currently may flip to the GOP in a week's time. We are reaching out this hour with our guests, Dennis Goldford of Drake University, Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa, with their analysis of the latest polls, the campaigning. We want to get your input this hour as well. Social media questions. Give us your take on the state of our politics in five words or less. Or with those five words, you can tell us what you will remember most about this campaign season. I shared a few in the first half hour. Let me share a few more. Here's a tweet from Chris. Empty Ernst, boring Bruce. A tweet from Mark. Hijacked by special interest money. A tweet from Paulina. Slander should not win elections. Email from Kathy. Intransigent, incompetent, obscenely expensive, unethical. Facebook post from Risa. My five words to sum up the race? Sponsored by non-Iowan billionaires. Bruce, before we get into these U.S. House races, to look at those, we have not had a single positive comment in reaction to our five words question. What does this tell you about the state of our politics? Dennis, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. I didn't.
Okay.
Sorry, didn't hear you say Dennis.
Okay, I'm sorry. Did I?
You said Bruce. I wasn't sure.
I am sorry. There was a Bruce in the tweet. I'm sorry. I got mixed up. But
That's okay.
Forgive me, please.
That's okay. Well, of course, as Chris knows, we don't know that this is a representative sample of all voters, and it might be the people who think it's awful are more likely to send in a tweet or some other social media message. But again, this has not been an enjoyable election season. I mean, quite often in an election year, and Chris may have similar experiences in his young career, I don't know, but by early to mid-October, I usually start to think, I wish I were a chemistry professor because I'm
I don't know if I go to chemistry.
Okay. I'm tired of all the screaming and yelling and nastiness. And in both 2012 and this year, by Labor Day weekend, that's the way I was feeling. It's not been pleasant. And I used at the end of my op-ed piece 2 weeks ago a respectable but still earthy expression. I said the campaigns, you know, we're voters, we're not mushrooms. So stop covering us with manure and trying to keep us in the dark. But that's the way I have felt at least since June, if not sooner, about these campaigns. I know they're not tea parties. I know politics is hardball. But still, it's hard to think of whether there's anything positive and substantive a voter would know coming out of all of this in terms of how we might make the country better.
We're trying to enlighten the situation, at least for the political junkies out there. We've just put up on iowapublicradio.org some new voter maps. And I know, Chris, you've had a chance to look at these. These are voter maps at iowapublicradio.org. There's also a link on our Facebook page where you can click into any one of the four congressional districts in Iowa and look at the individual counties in terms of voter registration, Democrat, Republican, independent, or third party, to get a sense of that. So let's, with that in mind, the voter maps, please use that as a resource at iowapublicradio.org. Let's start off with House District 1 as we look at the open House seats. Rod Blum, the Republican, facing Pat Murphy, the Democrat, and because that's where you are, Chris, let's tell us a little bit about the campaign, characterize it, and where we stand.
Well, I think the campaign, you know, reflects campaigns across the country. I mean, you have Rod Blum, the Republican, talking about the problems with the Obama administration, casting his opponent, Pat Murphy, as someone who supports Obama, who supports Obamacare, which we haven't talked about Obamacare yet, but it's funny that that's back in the as sort of a key phrase that we keep hearing over and over and over again, even though, you know, we thought it was maybe done with after the 2012 election, but now Republican candidates seem to be using it all over again. But Rod Blum, the Republican, talking about his opponent, Pat Murphy, the Democrat, as someone who would vote for Obamacare. Pat Murphy trying to shift the focus to talking about middle class issues. And that's something that's sort of been lost for Democrats. If you remember back at the beginning of this cycle, Democrats thought they could do well or at least hold their own on middle class so-called middle class issues like pay equity and minimum wage. That stuff has sort of been pushed aside by events beyond their control, you know, with the Ebola crisis, what's going on with ISIS, a number of other conflicts, you know, in the Middle East. But within that district, you know, it's a district that leans Democratic, but you have a disproportionately high number of no-party voters in the district compared to the other three. But it is a race that should lean Democratic, but I think is being drugged down a little bit by presidential politics.
Mm-hmm. I know we don't have nearly the polling that we do in the mm-hmm. open Senate race. Do we have any indications?
We
of
do.
Who?
I mean, the Loras poll the last couple of Loras polls have showed it within the margin of error, you know, a 1 or 2 point race for either candidate. So I think it's going to be very competitive. And again, it's going to come down to that turnout game. Are Democrats able to mobilize voters in a way that is superior to what Republicans are able to do and maybe repeat what they've done in 2008 and 2012.
Dennis Goldford, give us a profile of House District 3, the third district in your part of the state, Democrat Stacey Apple facing Republican David Young.
This is a district that after 2010, so as of 2012, with the new reapportionment and districting that occurred, became somewhat more Republican than it used to be. It's anchored in Polk County, which, of course, is the most populous county in the state. But as opposed to districts 1 and 2, where independents have a plurality followed by Democrats and then followed behind them by Republicans, and the fourth district where you have Republicans with a significant plurality and Democrats trailing badly there. In the third district, it's almost a third. It's got a slight Republican lead followed by independents closely, followed by Democrats closely. So it's pretty well even in the third district. And, of course, this was vacated or this race was opened up because Congressman Latham, after beating Leonard Boswell in the newly reconstituted third in 2012, decided he was finished. He had enough with the House and Congress and so forth, so he would retire. And we have, of course, David Young, who is a legislative assistant to Chuck Grassley for 20 years, and the Democrats are painting him. I've always found this interesting. They paint these folks as Washington insiders, but the people doing that are Washington insiders themselves, mm-hmm. the House campaign committees. They painted him as a Washington insider, which is always a nasty term to use around the country. And Stacey Apple, who was a state senator, who was defeated by Kent Sorensen in 2010, I think it was, before he ran into difficulties of his own. It's still pretty neck and neck. The turnout rates, as we've talked about, Republicans being somewhat more likely to turn out than Democrats for a midterm race, the turnout dynamics tend to favor Young at this point, but it still is probably as close as the Ernst Braley race.
Speaker John Boehner has been crisscrossing the country in recent days supposedly in a bid to run up the House majority, the U.S. House in control of the Republicans currently. Dennis, what is the payoff for Boehner if he can increase his majority? We know he's had sort of a fractious GOP conference there in the House. Is that something he's looking to remedy?
Well, it's hard to see how that would, except that he may not need as much of the fractious vote if he gets some other people coming in that support him. On the other hand, there was a piece on the web this morning suggesting a lot of the new members of the House on the Republican side would be mostly Southern Tea Party folks who aren't committed even to voting for Speaker Boehner as Speaker. So, Republicans like to run up their majorities so they have more room to spare in particular votes they might take. But the folks that come in, or even the folks that replace some of the incumbents who have retired, may well be even, at least in the South, they're more Tea Party than the people they're replacing, which causes further headaches for Speaker Boehner.
You mentioned, Chris, a few moments ago about events overtaking the wishes of the parties to control the mm-hmm. agenda in these campaigns. Looking at a recent poll by Politico, an overwhelming majority of voters in the most competitive 2014 elections say it's as if events in the U.S. are, quote, out of control, expressing alarm about, well, terrorism, anxiety about Ebola, harsh skepticism of both political parties. Two-thirds of likely voters saying they feel that the U.S. has lost control of its major challenges, and only 36% say the country is in, quote, a good position to meet its economic and national security hurdles. Let's talk a little bit about one of those threats, Ebola. Have your comments about how Ebola is affecting this campaign. But first, let's hear this. Speaking on the White House lawn in the White House yesterday, President Obama provided an update on the U.S. response to end the Ebola outbreak.
We don't want to discourage our healthcare workers from going to the front lines and dealing with this in an effective way. Our medical teams here are getting better and better prepared and trained for the possibility of an isolated Ebola case here in the United States. But in the meantime, we've got to make sure that we continue to provide the support of health workers who are going overseas to deal with the disease where it really has been raging. It's also important for the American people to remind themselves that only two people so far have contracted Ebola on American soil. The two Dallas nurses who treated a patient who contracted it in West Africa. Today, both of them are disease-free.
That was the president yesterday. The president's statements come at a time when two governors, Chris Christie in New Jersey, Andrew Cuomo in New York, have set mandatory quarantines, 3 weeks for healthcare workers exposed to people infected with Ebola in West Africa. One such nurse was detained in New Jersey until the White House complained and her lawyer questioned the legality of Governor Christie's quarantine. Here's Governor Christie.
Looks like you're going to have to defend this in court.
Well, whatever. Get in line. I've been sued lots of times before. Get in line. I'm happy to take it on.
Classic Chris Christie, get in line. Chris Larimer, you're at the front of the line. Tell us, how have you been observing Ebola as a threat affecting this campaign?
Well, I think it's interesting because, you know, there's an extremely small probability of, you know, any of us here in Iowa really having to deal with this directly. Yet I think what's happening with Ebola, it's been added to this list of things that is causing voters to feel uncertain, to feel a bit anxious about what's going on in the country. We already had an economy that most people viewed as being on the, or, you know, maybe two-thirds viewed as being on the wrong track in terms of the direction of the national economy. There were a crisis in the Middle East. There was a perceived threat from ISIS. And now you have an Ebola outbreak that's something that a lot of people simply don't understand. It's very scary what, you know, you some of the images that you see on TV. And so I think it's just adding to this general sense of uncertainty and anxiety and an inability to control things. And mm-hmm. I think when voters have that sense that they can't control things, that their leaders can't even control things, I think that creates more uncertainty and you know, causes people to maybe be more frustrated, obviously, than they normally would. And they're directing their frustration at the one person they see as the leader of the U.S. government, and that's President Obama. And so I think, and as a result of President Obama being a Democrat, you have Democrats around the country suffering as his approval rating goes down as well.
Do you see it that way, Dennis, that these anxieties and fears favor the Republicans?
Oh, yes. I'll say it less articulately than Chris did. There's an old line I heard that a lawyer is somebody who can hold two contradictory thoughts in his head at the same time. If that's the case, then Republicans are lawyers because they want to argue that President Obama is a dictator, all-powerful, looking to control every aspect of our lives, and at the same time they want to argue that he's incompetent. And the way the government has responded to the Ebola outbreak prompts at least initially the question of competence and the idea that the president can't manage his administration very well. And they look at this fellow Ron Klain as his Ebola czar, but he has no medical experience and hasn't shown up before the press, even though they said he's going to work mostly behind the scenes. So the Ebola aspect, or the Ebola issue, plays to the competence aspect of the Republicans' critique of the Democrats.
We've been having big name surrogates come to Iowa. Michelle Obama, Joe Biden, Hillary Clinton today at 2 o'clock in Cedar Rapids. I believe Chris Christie tomorrow with Governor Branstad in Burlington. Chris, how much do these surrogates help a campaign and win well selected?
Well, they don't do anything in terms of persuading voters. I think the idea behind doing this is just simply to get people excited, to get them to mobilize voters. Because I think the intent is, you know, you have someone like a Hillary Clinton or Bill Clinton's coming to Waterloo on Saturday, or other folks coming around Speaker Boehner. That gets people excited to see a national figure close to their own home. And then those campaigns set up shop at the event. They're trying to sign up people for early voting. They're trying to get people registered to vote, to try to get people, you know, locked into their camp for voting for Election Day. And so it's a way to get people excited, to get people out who maybe normally wouldn't come out just to see that candidate running, but they'd come out to see a national figure. And it's a way to get people to vote who maybe normally would not vote. So it's all about mobilization and enthusiasm. It has nothing to do with trying to persuade an undecided voter.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk, if we could, briefly. What can we say about the local races in the Iowa legislature? I don't know, Chris, if you've been keeping an eye on that. Are we likely to see any changes with control of the houses in the legislature?
Honestly, I think that's difficult to say. I mean, we have a number of races where are simply uncontested, which is not unusual. But as far as, you know, watching these races and paying attention to these races, they've been drowned out by everything else that's been going on with the U.S. Senate race. When the U.S. Senate race ads aren't airing, you occasionally see an ad by Governor Branstad. When that's not airing, Jack Hatch is back on the air, at least briefly. And so the state legislative races, to the extent that people are paying attention to them, I think they're hard to find information on. And so if that's the case, that would probably, you know, potentially favor an incumbent. But if the mood is so bad in Iowa in terms of being against Democrats, you know, you may have a slight Republican advantage there. I think it's just very, very difficult to assess right now.
Another new poll, comment on this, please, as we close our hour. Millennials, it seems, are fed up with both parties in Washington. This new poll, the Harvard University Institute of Politics poll, looking at millennials, we're calling those 18 to 29-year-olds. 56% of the so-called millennials say President Obama and congressional Democrats and Republicans are all responsible for the dysfunction in Washington. 53% of millennials say they would recall and replace all 535 members of Congress today. What do you find most interesting about this youngest category of voters, Dennis?
They tend to have the least information compared to other age groups about politics. They have less interest. They don't see how politics and government actually have an impact on their lives. And they're least likely to turn out. I mean, that's the difficult for Democrats. Democrats have three core constituencies. At least they're not the only three, but young people, single women, and minorities. And they tend to be, especially younger people, less likely to turn out for a midterm than for a presidential election. So these are precisely the people the Democrats need to show up if they're going to have any chance of doing well or at least holding their own in this particular election.
It's interesting also in this survey, Harvard University Institute of Politics survey, more than 2,000 respondents, U.S. adults under 30 largely find themselves beholden to neither party. 42% say they consider themselves to be independent voters, compared with 33% who call themselves Democrats and 22% Republicans. I wonder if this changes as people age. Is this typical for this age? Do they later then grow into the mold of the major parties? Your thoughts on that, Chris?
Well, I think, yeah, to some extent they do. I think, you know, the other thing to think about with this group is that they like things to happen quickly, or they're accustomed to things happening quickly, or that they can change their mind quickly, or that they can adjust and pick up new information whenever they want. You look at how Congress operates and how it's designed to operate. It's designed to be very, very slow, and that's very frustrating for that generation. And so, you know, this may be a group that, you know, if they're extremely frustrated, maybe they do push a little bit harder for, you know, a third party. But generally, folks fall into one of the two major parties because that's the easiest way to participate in the process.
Started off the hour by asking you, our listeners, for five words or less to talk about the state of our politics or how you will best remember this campaign season. A few more to share with you from Bill. His five words, ads, why bullying is ubiquitous. A tweet from Edward, be afraid, be very afraid. Five words from Christopher, hopefully Joni Ernst's concession speech from Christopher. Let's have what you will find most memorable about this campaign season. I gave you a forewarning of that before. Dennis Goldford, how will you characterize this campaign season?
The unbelievably negative onslaught, carpet bombing of ads. That stands out to me more than anything else.
Okay. And Chris?
Yeah, I guess I was going with the five-word limit. And I was afraid to follow Dennis because he always has something clever to say. But I would just add money making people unbelievably disgusted.
Okay. Let's go to Richard quickly on our phone line from Cedar Rapids. Richard, please make it quick.
Yes. One of the candidates for U.S. Senate has publicly been spoken in regards to being against negative campaigning ads. Rick Stewart has now challenged Iowans to vote against negative campaigning, and a vote for him would show that big money does not buy votes. What are your thoughts on that?
Okay, quickly, thoughts on that, perhaps to you, Dennis?
Well, independent or non-major party candidates often get hidden by even what we've said and by polling and things like that. It's a two-party system, and it's always a struggle for third-party candidates.
Mm-hmm. And yet we have that third party candidate in Kansas, Chris.
Yeah, like I said, that was just something that I don't think anybody really predicted. It was just that he was able to capitalize on Pat Roberts being vulnerable and the Democrats not really putting up a strong opponent, and there was an opening for an independent.
Quickly, Dennis, of the races we didn't talk about with incumbents, Dave Loebsack, Steve King, Terry Branstad, where do you see the most likely upset if there would be a big surprise in one of those races?
Well, Jim Maurer's been a very good candidate, but it's such a Republican-leaning district that it's hard to see how he'd be able to upset Steve King. Loebsack has a pretty Democratic district, but if the Democratic turnout isn't what he needs it to be, particularly Johnson County, he could have a scarier night than he might otherwise.
Anything to add to that about the incumbents, Chris?
No, and I think, you know, the surprise would be if Governor Branstad does not win by 10 points.
Okay. Thank you very much for being with us on this hour. Chris Larimer, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Dennis Goldford, Professor of Political Science at Drake University. Stay tuned. Just a few more days. Gentlemen, thank you for your analysis. We'll look forward to the final days of this race and its aftermath.
Thank you.
Sure thing.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, and Claire Roth. We had help from Tony Daner today and Sarah Bowden in Des Moines. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Tomorrow, we'll listen back to a conversation I had with best-selling author and Iowa Writers Workshop graduate Justin Cronin. He'll take us to his post-apocalyptic world in his vampire trilogy. That's tomorrow on this program. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.